Okay. Hi, RP. It's Monday. I want to just take a minute to talk a little bit about today's conversation. And I want to acknowledge that for me, I slept well last night. And I haven't slept well in, I don't know how long, but it's been a couple of weeks. It started for me before the George Floyd incident. She's pointing that out is that I do think it was made more difficult for me to sleep post that, but there was something going on for me over a period of time, and it goes back for me to my trip. It was just sort of my trip took me off balance in a good way. And what I mean by that is it made me think a lot about what I do with my life and how I can be helpful and where are the places in life I might be helpful, and also where are the problems in life that I wasn't aware enough. And then of course that's, you know, George Floyd and then the things that happened since that time only elevated that feeling for me in a big way. I mean, it was pretty intense. And then finally I slept last night. I can't say why. I don't know why last night I was actually able to sleep. Maybe I reached some kind of a point. I don't know. So, but let me just say that some of it is an anxiety that is about the world's just going to go back and get into a rhythm that is less than healthy. And I want to be part of something that isn't that, that is more healthy than it has been. And I want to be clear also to say I have way more questions than answers. You know, there's just so many things that I don't know. And I'm one person in one place in life, but so many people I trust have asked me to be willing to have uncomfortable conversations of a whole variety of kinds with a whole variety of kinds of people. So I'm going to try to do that, and I hope we can do that today. I'm going to attempt to do that. I'm just saying I don't want to be lazy. It's just sometimes I might not get it right. You know, I might be in an uncomfortable place that's maybe a waste of energy, and then I'll find uncomfortable places where that's the place. It won't be perfect, but I hope the attempt is solid. And kind of like last week, I thought, you know, if you look at the headlines, COVID is still around, but there's still so many question marks as far as I can see. We were talking about some of the helpful stuff we've seen. One was that epidemiologist piece from the New York Times that sort of outlined like activities, when you might do them, different people's opinions on when you can do those kinds of things. And so I want to talk about that a little bit. But then the other thing is that, you know, we have postponed our fall event into 2021, and we're trying to figure out how we can best apply all of our efforts in the ensuing months, because I do think we could put a lot of hard work that I hope would be helpful. The thing I want to make sure is that we do that hard work in such a way that it is most helpful, like most advantageous. So we're sorting through that too. So I want to talk about George Floyd. I want to talk about the aftermath of George Floyd. And I want to talk about COVID. I saw numbers were up in Texas. My gym opened today. I don't know how I feel about that. I miss the gym, but I'm afraid of the gym. By the way, outside, they're doing it outside. So maybe I can do it. So those are just my thoughts. And, you know, COVID, if you also want to talk about that uncomfortability thesis in advance of that, I'll go anywhere you want, but those are just the things that are on my mind.
Tom, great to see you again. Happy Monday. I'm in Wisconsin, where I went to high school, one of my favorite places in the world. The three boys and Kelly and I drove out here from the East Coast on Sunday. It was an amazing 14-hour drive. Great to see the country again and see the fields. It's just the beginning, obviously, of summer, so the cornfields are just about 2 inches high. It's kind of gorgeous. You were talking about having trouble sleeping. I'd say, you know, just two quick things, right? We've talked a lot about the uncertainty and the fear that comes from a pandemic. This is the first one we've had in 100 years, first one in our lifetime, our parents' lifetime, our grandparents' lifetime. What does it mean? It's deeply, deeply into our subconscious and our limbic system. So it's a scary, scary thing. And then you add to it that, you know, you do a number of conversations a day, and I'd say one theme through all of them, I think there's a couple, is you're really seeking to understand what's going on. So you're processing a lot of information, and the information isn't good, like, period, right? The actual news, what the actual headlines have been for the last 4 months has been just a huge string of bad news. So probably a healthy sign that you're not able to sleep very well right now. You were talking about the disease, and I think it's probably worth just noting, and we've said it before, this is a huge news week, obviously, right? But huge news month, huge news, you know, quarter of a year, but the last couple of weeks have been intense. But the disease hasn't stopped. The highest number of infections recorded to date happened yesterday. Now, I'll be able to tell you that every day. The number of infections is just going to go up for time as the disease has moved into Latin America and Southeast Asia and other places. The United States continues on a sort of a slow upward trend. I can tell you about our epidemiological curve. We've just finished a new take on it. I'm happy to share that with you. And so I'll just start with that.
Love that. Yeah, because it would be great to know. We all speculate. A lot of people are speculating. No one seems to know.
Yeah, well, you know, epidemiological curves at Ergo, we make the point every time we talk about them that they're a conjuring. It's just, you know, a dream of what would be if a series of assumptions hold true. So if everyone decides tomorrow, wow, I'm really going to freak out about this and lock myself away, and then the R naught transmissibility goes to zero, the curve flattens. If everyone says tomorrow, this is a hoax, and I'm going to go out and hug and kiss everyone I can, then the R-naught goes to 3 or 4, and it rips through the world, the country. So our conjuring of how people will behave based on using AI, using cell phone movement data, looking at the restrictions per county, per state, there are no federal restrictions. Our conjuring is that by August 1, there'll be about 155,000 dead in America. We're about 110,000, a little less dead today, I think. From this disease, and that you're basically looking at about, you know, if it helps, call it like a 20 degree upward slope, just kind of slowly moving up. But what, and so where's that going to be? Well, just remember, this disease, for most of America, and we've said it a number of times, but it bears repeating, for, you know, 47 states in the union, 46 states in the union, while people have died there, a huge percentage of them, well over 40%, probably died in elder care facilities, meaning not in everyone's face. Elder care facilities are locked away behind HIPAA protections, Healthcare Privacy Act protections. They're locked away because they're literally locked away for disease protections. Families aren't allowed to go into most of them anymore. So people are dying kind of in a hidden way. So for many states, you know, 40% of people who are dying invisibly. And then the number that remaining 60% is a small number, and it's a couple hundred, 1,000 people for many states. So this growth in death across America will be largely across the states that haven't been hit too hard before. And I don't think we're going to see large spikes in dense urban areas like we saw in New York City, like we saw in New Orleans, like we saw in Seattle, like we saw a bit in Chicago, clearly like we saw in Europe, in Lombardy and other areas. So I don't think we're going to see that panicked, the hospital's getting overwhelmed thing. We're just going to see a slow simmer of a continued number of people dying. And the final thing I would just mention is, and you know, remember the people largely who are dying are the elderly or those who are take pills, high blood pressure, diabetes, any other number of things, and those are folks in many instances again who are, you know, already hidden away. Final comment, because I think everyone's been curious and a lot of people have been asking, is what do the experts think about how the protests will impact the transmission of the disease? And our bet, and it's based on talking to some top epidemiologists, some of whom we've had on this show, our bet is that it will not greatly impact the transmissibility of the disease, people being outside and protesting and in relatively close quarters, because we think transmissibility cuts down at least 20% in the summer. UV rays matter. Humidity matters, temperature matters, and being outside and just wind movement matters, movement of people, movement of particulate matter. You know, we're talking about stuff flying through the air, and if you're moving around, you're not getting as much of it on your face. Just, it's disgusting, but true. So we think that won't matter so much from a protester perspective. It could seriously matter from people who are in prison. So 10 to 15,000 people have been arrested so far in the protests. Now, put that against a number of tens of millions of Americans who have gotten out and exercised their First Amendment right to protest. Tiny percentage have been arrested. That's another story worth commenting on. But of those people who are arrested and put away in prisons for even a few hours, if not a day or two, that's an area where we could see growth of the virus. And so I hope that prison officials are taking that very seriously.
It's complicated. You know, what was the word you used? I wish I could remember. You were sort of describing scenarios, which sounded like, I think what you meant was sort of the way people behave from a safety point of view. What was that word you used?
Optimistic. You said I was describing scenarios.
What was the word you used for?
Conjuring.
Conjuring. Was that conjuring? And the idea with conjuring is behavioral. Like in order to make your projections, you got to make behavioral projections to get them right in the first place. So there's certain assumptions.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. So look, in the beginning of this disease, we didn't really know what the disease was. So there was a lot of conjuring about the transmissibility of the disease. How does it do in different temperature scenarios? How does it do with different treatments? We didn't know. And we still are learning a tremendous amount about this disease every day. So there was conjuring on the disease basis, and that was really gray area. And we've learned more and more about that. And then there was a conjuring on how are humans going to interact with each other. And then there was a conjuring on the weather basis, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, picture someone in Fantasia rubbing a crystal ball and like little clouds of miasma is coming out. That's what epidemiological curves ultimately are. They're, you have to make assumptions and bets based on a whole variety of things, from the biology to human behaviors to weather, literally to weather. And you have to even think about things like the social unrest we're seeing right now, because that changes things up too. So we have, I think we have well over 40 or 50 factors that go into our epidemiological curve on a, you know, every moment basis. And we can tweak all those, and we do. And that ultimately is a conjuring. And almost none of it is based in hard science. So that said, our curve team at Ergo, and I have to give them credit, has been literally the most accurate we have seen in the world. So whatever it is they're doing and we're doing together, it's working. Now that's bad news, because our curve's always been a little more pessimistic than many of the accepted curves. And right now our curve or other curves are kind of getting to a similar direction as ours. So there's a number of other curves now predicting a similar slope in the United States to the Ergo curve.
Yeah. So help me understand something, RP. Help me understand why city living, in and of itself, with some degree of normalcy, isn't very dangerous. When I say some degree of normalcy, well, kind of like it was before, it's hard for me to understand.
I just missed the key word, the city limit?
Cities. Like, I think about New York. What is New York? New York is, the streets are crowded, the bodegas are crowded, the restaurants are crowded, the elevators have people in them, the lobbies have people in them.
So I said we were not going to see big, huge spikes in key cities, and you're saying why? It's a great question. And again, it's based on presumptions. And this is a different set of presumptions, right? So inside the category of human behaviors, remember how we've talked about how South Korea did such a great job with this disease right away? Like, they've had less than 1,000 people dead. They have 25 million population. The disease hit there earlier, and they have done an amazingly good job of keeping their economy alive, their people alive. Everything in South Korea is just humming. Same with Australia, a number of countries. But South Korea, I look at that example. There's tons of reasons they got it right. It has a lot to do with testing and tracing, this and that. Here's one big reason South Korea got it right. They had the sense memory. They had the history of MERS, Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, ripped through South Korea and terrified them not long ago. So they had gone through this, been scared by it. And so they were already wearing masks, not shaking hands, washing hands, kind of distancing a little bit, even before SARS-CoV-2 showed up in South Korea, and it showed up early, right? They're right near Wuhan, they're right near China. So why they did better because they remembered. They understood what was going on. Our presumption is that New York City, for example, people there will be a little more gun shy. They will be wearing masks. They won't be shaking hands. We will act in New York City like the South Koreans acted in Seoul right when the disease broke out. They were already aware, already being safe. Now let's flip that over. Let's imagine we went to, I don't know, what city would you pick is like the middle of denial and doubt about this virus right now? Pick one. So let's say City X. You know, City X is probably somewhere around Oklahoma or something. We're like, no, there's zero disease here. This is a farce. I don't believe it. Place like that would have a real problem if they had a high density insult, a lot of sick people, and they were taking public transport, and it was, you know, the winter and they were inside, et cetera, et cetera. So why the cities? People will be safer. That's a huge reason, more mask wearing primarily. And B, it just ought to, the weather ought to still help there too. That's why we think cities will not have the spikes.
Yeah. Okay. I want to keep checking in on this because I think it's important.
Yeah, we got to keep watching the disease. And, you know, let's hope that a lot of the experts are right. And let's hope that the protests don't lead to increased transmission. And if that's the case, that's a heck of a blessing that this didn't happen in the winter or something.
So to George Floyd, so I'm going to tell a story that is just one little guy's story, being me. And its significance to the world is de minimis, maybe, but to me it was significant. It is de minimis to the world. Let me just be clear on that. I've never in my life posted anything political in social media. It's just not who I am. I'm not criticizing anyone who does. I'm not saying anything like that. But one of the things that I've been doing is having just so many conversations, and I'm having conversations with a variety of people. Some of our interns, some of our keepers are Stacy Woodland from Pottstown, Pennsylvania is a keeper. Some of our former speakers, some of my friends. So just a whole variety of conversations. And, you know, to me, the picture of the Black Lives Matter yellow symbol in the street across from the White House, where you can see both the White House and the words, is so historic. It's just so, like, talk about potency, just a message that's so clear and significant and so many things, you know, so many things. By the way, it's you consider the speed with which that happened, and by the way, the beauty of the color, the beauty of the size of the letters, the execution of the artwork. I think about these kinds of things. In some ways it doesn't matter, but it's what I think. And you got to pass the ordinance, buy the paint, do the design, clear the street, paint the street, let it dry. Like, there's all the stuff you got to do. And they did it so quickly. And then you get a result, and the result is this beautiful modern yellow work of art set against a classic, you know, European inspired White House where the top office in America sits. Like, it's just amazing. Amazing to me. It's just had such historical significance. And, you know, in talking to some people, I felt, you know, the thing I heard from some of my Black friends was sort of like, I want to know where you stand, and it would be helpful if you would say where you stand more publicly. And those are totally fair questions and statements and opinions that people had. And my instinct became, I want to do that. Now, I was late to the game. I mean, you know, this wasn't like, I wasn't like the first guy doing this. And then I called a friend of mine who had done it, who also had never posted anything political in their lives either. And I just said, how did it feel? And just others are those kinds of questions. Okay, so I did it is the simple case. I'm not saying in any way it's like noble or heroic or anything. But it felt so comfortably the right thing to do. The second person to like it was my brother, who also doesn't do anything political. And I got very emotional. I felt hopeful. I felt all these different things. Anyway, I just said a lot. And again, I do believe it's small in many ways, but it felt big for me and sort of asked me to be a new me who I hope doesn't get busy with regular life and forget. Anyway, I'd love to just hear anything you have to say about that. And I thought it might be something helpful and valuable to share.
When this first happened, when the disease first kind of caught America unawares, one of my very deepest mentors wrote a piece. I was saying pretty regularly and on this show and right from the beginning, like, let's not look back. Let's not finger point and blame. Let's solve clearly where we need to spend our efforts. And this mentor of mine wrote a piece that said, it's critical that we look right now at how we failed so dramatically. This is just the disease first, how we failed so dramatically because we have an election happening and because we have to figure out what we did wrong so like we can correct ourselves immediately. Meaning where I had took a lot of comfort in like, let me not be political, let me be independent, let me just look forward. I was awoken up to the reality that you can't make a better decision tomorrow if you don't realize the errors you made today. And those errors go all the way to deciding who we pick as leaders, right? Leaders matter. Plans matter. Warnings matter. Being reasonable and empathetic and bringing hope in a place of fear to people matters. And right now, that's not what's happening, right? So on the disease, I would say very clearly, we had the most abject failure of American leadership we have ever had on any major issue. We've never had a president so outclassed by a problem. That's a fact. There's no parsing that one, right? And then you get to George Floyd, and you get to the protests, the beautiful protests we have in America right now, and you get to a whole different set of challenges for our government and a continued amount of failure. And to some ways, a more horrific failure, because there's actually a playbook for that one. There was no playbook for the pandemic. Now, footnote, and we'll get to that later. There was, we kind of lost it, like, et cetera. South Korea had one, and Australia had one, and we had written one, but we lost it, literally. But anyway, there is no playbook on a pandemic so much as there actually is a playbook on how you deal with protest. And how you let people exercise their First Amendment rights, right? It's not the 28th Amendment or the 50th, or it's number one. The First Amendment is the right to protest. There's a playbook. It's called the Constitution. It's very easy to follow. You know, you swear an oath to it when you take the presidency. So I was having a meeting with a couple friends who are diehard Republicans, and they're diehard Trumpers, and I know they are. And I said in the meeting, and it wasn't about politics, I said, you know, I'm a Republican. And they both said, you're not a Republican. And I said, well, historically I have been. I voted for Republicans. I founded a conservative newspaper at one point. I worked for a neoconservative think tank. And for a lot of people who've listened to 54 episodes of us and they hear me say this, they might be like, what are you talking about? Very much like these two friends of mine said, you're not a Republican. And I said, I'm not a Republican right now. I'm certainly not a Trump Republican. But a lot of the classic Republican Party ideals, which let's call them Bush 41 ideals and previous to that, are ones that I hold pretty deeply. So I understand. I'm with you, Tom, on it's time to realize we need a change. And we can do that in a nonpartisan way. We can do that in a way we're not attacking anybody. Ideally, we can do that in a way that's not divisive. Because the division largely sown, well, not largely sown, also sown by the White House, also sown by the clickbait media. The division has really been one of our big problems.
I don't want to give myself any room on the comfortable question. You know, being in uncomfortable conversations, I don't want to give myself any leeway on that. I don't want to give myself any leeway on intensity. You know, intensely look at questions. I'm a little more patient on answers because I think this is pretty complex. And again, I'm just trying to be reasonably realistic because I feel like otherwise... like if I was going to make a New Year's resolution today, it wouldn't be come up with an answer by January 2nd. Like I wouldn't do that. I think it'd be unwise. So as I sort of sift through what I think an answer might be in the small ways that I might be able to help or the people around me might be able to help, I want to listen a lot, you know, taking action all the while. But I think a lot of what you just said, you know, so much of what we're talking about here is prioritization and that notion that life's too busy to help, right? I got too much other stuff to do. I got to do this other thing. And I think that is me telling myself and for many people, not everybody, them telling themselves something of a lie. They are assuming a certain norm that I think is out of place. Yes, modern culture has taught us we have to do all these things. Go to work, wake up, do this thing, do that thing, all these other things. I don't know if it's actually true. And again, there are some people who maybe it's exactly true. I think it's less true for most of us than we might assume. And so, you know, Bryan Stevenson says, be proximate. Right, which he's saying, be near others, different kinds of people. If you don't know who he is, he's a black man who, you know, he gets people off death row and these amazing stories. He's also a beautiful speaker and he's a super thoughtful guy. Well, the act of being proximate takes time. Like you gotta get in your car and go somewhere or ask somebody to come see you or whatever it might be. And it might take away from time at work, and it might take time away from other things that you might be doing in your life because, like all of us, you're going to say your life is busy. Well, part of what you're indicating to yourself right there, whether you know it or not, is that all those other things are somehow more important, right? And so when you talk to Neil, and somebody can say to Neil, you know, keeping kids off the street, well, they just have no idea what Neil actually does for a living. And it might be valuable to go see Neil at Neil's school, spend a day there, maybe get involved. And Neil's in Florida, and you could do that locally. You could do that by meeting friends and family and other people, again, who you might not normally do, in ways you might not normally do. So part of what someone said, is it because of sponsors that you don't? I was like, no, I've never been interested in telling people what my politics are. I've never had that instinct to tell people what my politics are. And I said, well, this time you're going to do it. You're going to do it because it seems more right. It's going to be uncomfortable. You're going to do it. And again, it's a small act, but I really want to ask myself those questions. What are the other things like that that I prioritize on a given day that serve one need instead of another need? Because in the end, this need is about humans and love and things that are so much more important than many of the other things that I do. Like be part of a club. And what I mean by that is a political party. You know, like, okay, well, that's not as important as this thing. Anyway, I don't know if any of that makes sense.
Of course it does. There was a video that was pretty popular called The Great Awakening. And it was very beautifully done, and it was about a young dad reading a story to his young child. And I suspect half of people on here have seen it. If you haven't, look for it. It's beautiful. And a friend of mine criticized, and it's about, look, here's this moment when we all have to go lock away into our homes. Again, the forever footnote on that, those of us who had the privilege to do so, not the essential workers who had to go to work. And thank God many of them did. But for those of us who were forced to slow our lives down greatly, or at least slow down our travel and stay home, this little video described that it could be a time of a great awakening. And you awaken to your family, awaken to yourself, awaken to a great book, etc. And I think that was a very, very powerful thing, that there was this moment. And this moment's still going on, and we hope we carry that with us, right? And one thing that we discussed a lot is about this idea that we all have to be leaders now, Tom. And that to lead means to make decisions, right? There's a few key critical steps to be a leader, and one of them is to make decisions and make well-informed decisions. And that means to confront uncomfortable conversations. So maybe part of the awakening is, one, we do have to lead now. We have to lead ourselves for our own health and our family for our own health, and ourselves within this context of this great maybe racial reawakening we're having in this country, or awakening. I'm not sure when we did it the first time. You know what? That was horrible. I'm so sorry. I lost myself. I can do it again quickly. I apologize. Tom, there was a video called The Great Awakening that you might have seen, and it was talking about how while we're being locked away at home, it's an opportunity for us to reconnect with our thinking, with our thoughts, take a little time to decide what we're doing within the helter-skelter rush of the day. And inside of that, ideally, the awakening is to uncomfortable thoughts as well. If you decide, I'm not going to have a conversation on who our president should be, then you're not confronting an uncomfortable reality that all of us need to do. A civic duty to decide to vote. That's uncomfortable, right? Within that conversation, but maybe this awakening now is about, we've located our family, we know who we are, and for my family at least, it's been a moment of really reconnecting, and it's been kind of powerful and beautiful. Again, this sort of forced, locked away point of view. That's, again, if you're not a primary worker who has to go out and work for all of us. So now, perhaps what I hear you saying is, can we broaden that visage, our vision, beyond just our four walls? And look at other people. So the George Floyd protests ideally are forcing us to do that. And a lot of the unequalness that we saw in America exposed by the virus hopefully forced us to do that. This gets back to our conversations about Hillbilly Elegy by J.D. Vance, the book after Trump won that many privileged Americans had to read to realize they were very unprivileged Americans, unprivileged white Americans as well. So those taking the scales off your eyes moments are very powerful for us to re-engage as citizens inside the fabric of the nation. So it could be a special moment for that. And if there's anything you and I can do to forward that progress, that's an awesome thing to do. So one conversation I've been having a lot, and I'm gonna totally call them out now, is with my parents. And my parents are both lifelong Republicans. My mother has finally decided to kind of announce that she's not gonna vote for Trump. She's a deep Christian. There's lots of aspects of Trump's support of what she thought of the church, I think, that she found important. And I think she was, well, we'll leave it at that. She now has said she's not going to vote for Trump, and that's a change. She lives in Florida, so it matters. It took a while to get my father there, but I think, you know, Dad, I'm now like publicly committing your vote because you've now said you've had enough of this leadership. So that's the kind of conversation that can make a difference too. Beyond our four walls, talking to other people. Not proselytizing politics, but figuring out what we need to do together to move forward. And one thing I'd love to talk about today, Tom, while I'm kind of rambling here, is about the really neat news that I think happened from Neil's video and this idea of CEOs being leaders that maybe we can talk about as well today or at some point.
I saw that and I was got emotional when he said Neil's name. You know, I thought, wow, that's really interesting. It was powerful. Yeah, I mean, it's funny, you mentioned Trump. I was never a Trump person, which I'm not pointing a finger and just trying to tell you where I come from. I did not support Donald Trump when he was on The Apprentice. I mean, whatever. So I'm not that guy. But I find what has happened in the last few weeks just so egregiously bad, and so what I would call un-American, what I would call inhuman, what I would call immature, what I would call angry, divisive, just so many things. I mean, I find it so disappointing, and like posting what I did online the other day, I'm getting more comfortable saying it because, you know, I haven't mentioned a political policy through every word I just said. I was talking about human behavior and love and leadership, and it is, I never want my children to be anything like that man at all. Nothing like that. And I would, you know, I think about, I love Nelson Mandela, just as an example. Wow, you're talking about a massive gulf between Nelson Mandela and Donald Trump. And I hope that our country, which I do believe at its soul is really beautiful. I think the document that formed it is beautiful. I'm talking about the Constitution, not the Declaration. Not that I have anything against the Declaration, but that requires a certain kind of thing. And this thing is not going to help that thing. This thing being this person is not going to help that idea. And I've struggled hard to imagine how you could look at that just logically any differently. And I know people do, but I would tell you clearly that I do not.
A few weeks ago, maybe as few as 7-8 days ago, I had a crisis of conscience about my country. And we talked about it a little bit in these conversations. And I was writing notes to my friends, and some of the talks we were giving here and other places, I was wondering if the dream of America was largely a perpetuated hoax on labor and on workers, and if it had always been that way, if it obviously was a hoax on the slaves. And then, you know, has it been a perpetuation of a hoax? Like, is there actually a dream and a set of shared ideals in a knit fabric of this country, or was it just capital taking advantage of labor and putting a nice frosting and cherry on top and selling it as a series of ideals? And I went through this debate with myself, and talking to Neil and talking to you and talking to a variety of other extraordinary thinkers, I pull myself out of this, you know, sort of metapolitical depression, and I am now back on board where I've been the rest of my life, that it's not a hoax in any way, and it's a matter of how we decide to lead this country and what, if we're going to get back to the ideals that we do and should share, right? And in so doing, you realize, for all the great this country has done domestically and abroad in hundreds of years, and there's been an unbelievable amount, and I would refer you back to Pax Americana, from 1944, call it, to now. Really, Pax Americana probably ended in 2000 or 99, 90, something in that area. But this period of economic growth throughout the world from the end of World War II to now was largely because of American design and leadership, and has been the greatest period of human well-being in history. So there's an example of, when we get it right, how beautiful it can be. Were there tons of warts and disasters along the way? You got it. But was America amazing along that period of time? You got that too. So this, leading this nation, trying to live up to these ideals, is a massive sacred trust, and we can only give that to someone who's worthy of the trust. And so getting back to that, it is a work in progress all the time. And if we don't get back to that ideal, then it's not going to work. And if that's not political, I don't know what is, but you got to pick the right person.
Yeah, you know, so I mentioned this the other day, but Akhil Amar is a professor at Yale, constitutional law, and I took the class when I was there. I believe I didn't complete it, but I was there. I might have completed it. I don't remember, but I will look. It doesn't matter. The opening lecture, he's an Indian-born, very left-wing professor, which matters to a certain extent. But the reverence with which he described the Constitution was so strong. It was so beautiful. I mean, he talked about we the people as like one of the most brilliant three words ever written, you know, and he was so passionate about it. And I left feeling so happy, you know, because I was actually ready for cynicism and all these other things. And instead I left with this sense of like, wow, you know, a three-fifths clause is terrible. You know, there's a bunch of things in it that weren't good. Okay. But the general body of the idea was pretty powerful. And And here's the thing. So yeah, that's good news. And to me, that's really good news. And it relates to a lot of what you were just describing. The thing is, it turns out that the words don't solve all the problems. That the humans got to do it. Like the humans, like you got to actually treat each other in certain ways. And you got to love each other. And you got to behave. And you got to feel loving. Okay, I'm going to keep using the word. Loving towards the idea. Because if you're loving towards the idea, it's really hard to say when they start looting, we start shooting. I mean, it's just, or when the looting starts, when the shooting starts, whatever it is, you get the idea. You can't, that doesn't work. That won't fit. That's not going to fit within that idea. And the logic just breaks down. And, you know, we were talking about this the other day, too, that so many of the functions of government are not written down. They're precedent based, right? And behavior, most of it isn't written down. It's precedent based. But if you yield, if you go to this idea of love, just go there, just try it on. It changes the way you approach things fundamentally, including, I think, this one of, am I going to be too busy to have uncomfortable conversations and be part of a solution? Now, last thing I'll say today about this. I really do not believe that's weirdo, wacky Tom speak. I think that's historical. I think that passion allowed us to defeat Hitler. I think that those passions allow us to work through our challenges. I think that this is actually universally true, and that the real issue is just lack of acknowledgement in it and lack of focus on it, and not that this is somehow a new idea, because it's not. But maybe taking an opportunity to think about it is powerful. I watched The Social Network over the last 2 days. It's on Netflix right now. Quentin Tarantino had said it's the best movie of the decade. And I thought, I wonder, because I saw it before. I don't remember thinking of it that strongly. But it is so good. Anytime Aaron Sorkin writes, it's so powerful. So that part of it I thought was incredible. But the other part of it was, you know, it's a story of a relining, a reconfiguration of human culture. I mean, they talk about it. They talk about in the formation of the idea that this will be a virtual one of these and a virtual one of those and what all those things mean. And then you just cut to today. The movie ends with today there are 500 million people on Facebook. Today, I think there's like 3 billion or something, more than 2 billion, whatever the number is. And I just thought, my God, have we created this new and different world? And how do these principles... Not that they're not there. I'm not saying they're not there. I'm just saying we don't have much time for them. They don't get the time that they're due such that we can be a better nation.
In any reality, in any orb, in any office, in any room, in any country, you know, the people who carry with them long-standing ethics and morals and well-proven models of behavior are the ones who are going to be the best leaders online, in the Oval Office, in the boardroom, in the kitchen. And, you know, it's why will I honk at somebody on the highway, yet I wouldn't yell at somebody in the office for standing in my way on the way to the coffee machine, right? Like, why would I write something nasty to someone on the internet, yet I wouldn't say that to them on the phone, you know? Why do these different modes of communication or anonymity allow us to forget some of those core precepts of ideally what made us, you know, special people or a special nation? And I go back to something that at the time a lot of people thought was silly, but I don't know if you remember, very, very early in his presidency, Bill Clinton walked into the Oval Office and he stood by the Resolute Desk, which is this very special desk in the Oval Office that came from a U.S. Navy ship from the War of 1812, and it's been built from the timbers of that ship. And of course, we're in the Oval, and Bill Clinton walked up to the Oval, to the Resolute, and he sat with one hip on the desk, and he had on a pair of very short running shorts. And it was a bit of a kerfuffle, like compared to Ronald Reagan, who would not enter the Oval Office without a coat and tie on. And you couldn't take your coat off inside the Oval, and you had to address him as Mr. President all the time. Respect for the office, respect for the precepts and the ideals and the antecedents and the precedents and the morals. And so a lot of people saw that as a symbol of this man doesn't understand the dignity of the office, and it meant a lot to them. Likewise, you know, I think any president, any leader of anything needs to go into it with the best set of morals they can, and then needs to become better by being girded in what that office or that opportunity brings them. And that gets back to this, you know, there's a holy aspect of leading any group of people, let alone this country. And if we can't find that, then we're going to continue to be adrift. And if anything right now, we're adrift. We don't have clear leadership on what we ought to do or why we ought to do it. And that leads to all sorts of negative outcomes for us as a nation and as individuals. So I'm with you, Tom. And I know we said a lot of words about this, but look, if it gives you any comfort, remember, again, back to those documents that you love so much, like, this isn't your opportunity and your right, it's your duty to be politically active and to vote. So let your opinion be known. But we're not going to turn this into a political talk show, I know that.
Well, and I guess, let me try this on, which is a little counter to what you just said. I'm open-minded to challenging what the right thing may be. Now, how far afield, I want to be responsible in what I believe is effective as a way to change and grow, for sure. And that's a lot of where my own philosophies come from. You know, it's, to be a version of a contrarian is something I've always been interested in because I think it can be really effective. You know, you've heard it before, but when they did consumer testing on touchscreens back in the early, before the iPhone came out, everyone was thought, no, these suck. We don't want these. Well, okay. That don't pay too much attention to that. And in a similar vein, like the things that we might do to be helpful and to make a more loving culture, I'm going to be a little open-minded on what that might mean, and talk about it. Navigate through it. And the other thing I think we should think a lot about is who are the people that we want to talk to here, who can challenge us, you know, because look, this was a COVID show. I said this last week. This was not started to talk about this topic. I'm glad we're here. Glad we're here in the sense that I'm glad we're talking about this. I'm not glad we got here. And now the world is a different thing. And so I want to be sure that as we approach this thing, we're doing it well. And, you know, I'm not questioning it per se, but I'm thinking about it.
It's an unbelievably important time in America. Unbelievably important. Ridiculous challenges behind us. Well, gosh, I mean, the coronavirus and the protests and trying to begin to rebalance the tables on equities in this country, we're right in the middle of it. We're just opening our eyes to it. The disease isn't going away. So we better make good decisions or we're going to pay for it, continue to pay for it. So, you know, if we can talk to smarter people and learn more in that direction, I can't think of anything more worthwhile. And if people, you know, who are other parts of this conversation can get anything out of it, that's awesome. And, you know, and again, an example, and I think maybe we should do a whole show on it, but maybe we can tease it. One of my dearest, dearest friends was gracious enough to watch our interview with Neil Phillips. And I want to talk about what happened from that. Is that a good time? Do you want to do that now?
Sure. Introduce. I mean, we're at 58 minutes, so, you know, I want to stay under an hour, but we can cut.
All right, well, let's introduce it. That's perfect. Let's tease it up. And I'm looking at him right now. So one of my dearest friends in the world runs a great American manufacturing business that you've heard me talk about called Sloan. They employ thousands of Americans in union and non-union, well-paying manufacturing jobs. Not a lot of those left in America. It's a product everyone in America uses all the time. It's the, when you go to an airport and the sinks turn on automatically, when you put your hands underneath them, that's a Sloan valve. When you use the toilet with a silver handle on the side, that's a Sloan valve. And it, again, it's a 125-year-old company founded in Chicago by a man with a sixth grade education. And it was about sanitation and hygiene, also a critical issue right now. So there's a lot going on with this company. They watched that conversation with Neil, the CEO, Graham Allen, watched that conversation with Neil that I thought was amazing, Neil Phillips. And he sent me a video, 8-minute video that he sent to his entire Sloan workforce. It's on Vimeo, so it's anyone can see it. Maybe we'll put the link up when we do this conversation later. And in that conversation, he talked about what he learned from Neil. Graham is a white man like me, so he was very clear about what he can and can't talk to with any authority and how much he needs to listen and learn. But he talked about what he learned from Neil. And he said, I've been motivated, you know, that we need to do something. We have a long history in this company of being on the right side of these issues for generations and generations. But let's now reaffirm, double down on our efforts to do something to fix this stuff. And so what he did, as he called up, actually wrote letters to, I think, the police chief and the mayor in every town where they employ people. And basically said, look, I'm a big constituent in your town. I employ a lot of your people and I put a lot of money into your economy. I don't know if he said that, but that's an implication, obviously, when you get a letter from the CEO of Sloan. And here's just a series of questions. I'd like you to let us know about how you're thinking about these issues. I'm not castigating you. I'm not criticizing you. But I don't want a Sloan employee to be the next person under the knee of one of your police officers. I don't want your town, our shared towns, to be on CNN for bad news. I want them on CNN for good news. So here's some questions I'd like you to get back to me on. And that, to me, is so profoundly powerful because it does two things, right? It's leadership. We all have to lead now. We all have to lead now on the disease and on these social equity issues. And it's rebalancing the relationship with criminal justice and local leadership in a way that we have to remember, right? There's a great quote that the citizens shouldn't be afraid of the police department. The police department should be afraid of the citizens, right? Serve and protect. And we have to rebalance that relationship so that our local governments and our federal governments know that they are here at the pleasure of the people to serve us. And I thought that that set of letters was a really cool way of doing that. So Tom, maybe we can talk more about that going forward. That was a pretty lengthy introduction, but it's something I'm really, really proud of. And I think you and Neil, you know, there's a concrete example of a major employer trying to do something motivated by what Neil had to say to him.
It's great. It's great. RP, we will be anxious and interested to see where you end up next. And thank you for spending the time, and we'll continue to talk this week.
Thanks, Tom. We're in Wisconsin, and we'll get better backdrops for the next couple conversations. I got a Wi-Fi problem, and then we're headed west across the northern parts of America for the next couple weeks. So it's going to be a lot of fun. Great to see you as always, and apologies for being a little delayed with the tech this morning.
No problem. Great to see you.